Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller. Hey everybody, welcome back to Rated G Radio. It's the Wednesday show, and tonight we're going to be welcoming Mr. Bruce Hart to the show in just a couple of moments. He is somebody who I think is just absolutely fun and fascinating, and we're going to find out all about the crazy stuff that's going on in Bruce's life, including a new movie project and TV projects that he's been working on and so much more. But just a real quick recap for the week so you kind of know where we're going and also where we're, you know, where we've been. Last night we had Mr. Rob Watson. Many of you know him if you're up in the Santa Cruz area. He's the popular co-host of Out in Santa Cruz on KFCO 1080 AM. He does a fantastic show on Saturday nights at 7. Rob was on last night talking marriage equality and the recent Supreme Court ruling that has given the country such a stir and rainbows on Facebook profiles and everything else. So if you want a fun hour of banter between Rob and I, tune into last night's show. I'm now taking all of our episodes and converting them into YouTube channel episodes after we're done. So you can either listen to it right here on Rated G Radio here in the archives, or if you're just, you know, like lounging around on the YouTube, you can go ahead and check out my YouTube channel and all of the episodes moving forward are going to be on there. We're also going to be converting to a video format shortly, so you'll be able to kind of see what's going on while the show is taking place. Trust me, it is extremely fascinating. You'll want to stay tuned for all of those episodes. I may start this next Monday. I just have to work out some technical details. Tomorrow night we have Rebecca Fisk. She's a psychic. She's going to be back on. She usually comes on once a month, but we had such an overwhelming response to her appearance a couple weeks ago. I said, can we sneak in one more time before your regular appearance later on in July? So she's going to indulge us. And so for all of the people who are listening tonight, the secret to get your call answered is to call in at 6:45, get in 15 minutes before the show actually goes live. That's when the call queue opens up and we can get your call screened. And then Friday, we've got DJ David B. out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. He's supplying 2 hours of nonstop fun to get your 4th of July weekend started off. I've got a sneak preview of it that I've been blasting for the last week. And I'm going to tell you, if you haven't heard of DJ David B. yet, he's going to be somebody that you will love to listen to, and I'm hoping I can twist his arm to become a regular contributor here on the program. But without further ado, time's a waste, and let's get to our superstar guest star that's here tonight. We have Bruce Hart. Bruce, how are you? Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, hello there. I'm doing just great. Thanks for having me on your auspicious show. And I have to say, I'm going to call in because I want to talk to the psychic.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, before I came to California, Bruce, you know, I thought psychics were crazy. I thought, you know, crystals were crazy. Magnetic jewelry was crazy. Essential oils are crazy and all of that. I drank all the California Kool-Aid. But one of the benefits of doing this is that I've got a lot of really good qualified people that have, you know, documented their either training or all of their abilities ahead of time. So anytime I have people like Rebecca on the show, the people line up out the door to have their questions answered. And oftentimes, Bruce, and this is what I really love about this, the guests will call back in, you know, maybe the month later, 6 months later, something like that, and says, oh my gosh, what you told me was exactly what happened. I can't believe how accurate you were. So it's things like that, you know. So if they said, you know, I think you're going to dye your hair purple and move to Monaco, you know, I would say that probably is not going to happen. I'm going to think twice about having that guest back. But when, you know, we have so many people that call in and say, you know, it'll be you, Bruce. You'll call back in December and go, I can't believe what you said was true, Rebecca. So if you want to get in tomorrow night, I'll make sure you get in.
I definitely am going to try. The thing is I do believe there are people that are in touch with the spirit world and that can tell us to a degree what's going on. Before I moved to California a million years ago, I actually consulted with a psychic, and in many of the things that she told me that would come true came true for me, both the good and the bad. And I remember at one point I was sitting down with my close friend Steve, who helped me move out here, and we were, because, you know, I told him about it, and we were saying, you know, it's kind of scary, you know, how many things she was able to predict. It's amazing, you know, when you find somebody that can really tap into that other world, it's just amazing. And before we get too far, go ahead. Before we get too far off the subject, there's two things I wanted to talk about. back to what you were talking about when you were introing the show about marriage equality. You know, I'm from Midland, Michigan, you know, that little town in Michigan that has been kicking and fussing about marriage equality. And it was a very conservative little town. I grew up in it, you know, it was very safe and all of that. But I did move away because, you know, you really couldn't be gay and be there. So I was 18, I got out. But I've been sort of keeping in touch through this page. And I'm seeing all these young people and people that I knew that have totally swung around the other way now. They're pro-marriage equality. It's just wonderful. Well, anyway, you know, of course, the Supreme Court ruled on the right side of history. And the courthouse said they weren't going to issue licenses. And then they said they wouldn't have marriages on site, you know, just to be mean-spirited. Well, the good news is they were overruled.
Nice.
It just came out there. I know. I'm so happy. There's hope for my little hometown after all.
Well,
so, you know, this is kind of my feeling on this. I think people are going to fall in line. We're going to see some backlash. But by and large, people are just going to get over it, you know?
I totally agree with you, Bruce. I think that one of the things that is going to be very interesting is the people who are going to have that kickback and are going to say, well, we're not going to do whatever. Very quickly, they're going to come around and go like, you know, boy, what was I thinking? That was the dumbest thing I've ever done. I don't know why I didn't support this, because it doesn't impact me. They didn't say I had to get gay married. So, you know,
right.
Life goes on. And so I think we're going to be very surprised in the next 6 months, next year. We'll look back next June 26th and say, you know, a year ago, here's where we were at. Hopefully there will be a lot of laughs about how easy the transition was for all of these people who really wanted to be so hard-nosed. But, you know, we'll see.
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope so. And, you know, I'm of a certain age. When I was a kid, actually, interracial marriage was still illegal in some states. Now people are going to try to do the math that are listening in. But it's amazing to even think. When I think about that, I'm like, how is this possible? How is this possible that in my lifetime, you know, and I feel like I'm really young, that something so awful as that. So, you know, and people have gotten over that. They really have. So I think they will eventually adjust and adapt to marriage equality. And something else I wanted to bring up, and it's not really related or germane to what we're going to talk about, but there's a nightclub in West Hollywood called The Factory, and it is legendary. It has been there, I think since the 60s. And I don't know if you know about what's going on in West Hollywood. I don't live there, but I spend time there. It's getting, the whole city's getting gentrified, and they're tearing down, and they're building hotels where they shouldn't be building hotels, and destroying traffic flow, and basically destroying the community. And The Factory, which is right across the street from the Abbey, is now under fire. They're saying they might want to tear it down and build luxury housing. So there's a petition circulating. I'm going to put it on my Facebook page, but a lot of us are up in arms about it because that's a piece of history. It's changed names a million times. I think it was even called Studio One at one time. But, you know, it's legendary. And it also has parking.
Well, it's huge. Nobody it's has like, parking.
You don't tear down a building that has parking. I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking, but I'm certainly going to circulate the petition. So if people are listening and are so inclined to go to my Facebook page, please fill out, you know, sign the petition. We need to stop this senseless tearing down of history in California.
Well, you know, so Bruce, you've just committed yourself to come back to talk about that issue on another night in the future. So we'll have you back to talk about, you know, historic landmarks and things that we should be doing. But the thing that is crazy about this is, you know, they can go ahead and tear that building down to make a quote-unquote affordable housing. What is affordable housing anyway? I think that's kind of like an oxymoron here in Southern California anyway. But you know, they're going to, you know, tear it down and then build something up. And, you know, the pricing for that is still going to price out most people with, you know, quote-unquote regular incomes coming in to that entire area anyway. So it's just kind of laughable that they're going to say, oh, we're going to, you know, put in 50 units or something like that or whatever that magic number may be and expect to fix all of the community's ills.
It's frustrating. And rents are up in the thousands up there right now. I don't even know who's able to afford that. You know, I mean, I would say move out of town. I mean, I
have
to pay $4,000 for an apartment. That's a nightmare. Yeah.
I'd say, you know, what is this, New York City? You know, that's just absolutely crazy. But, well,
alas.
Let me tell you, we could talk about New York City and rents for, or even San Francisco, where you can pay, you know, $1 million for a 300 square foot apartment. But what's more interesting, I think, tonight, Bruce, is you and your career and all of the projects that you are involved in. So kind of circling back to, because otherwise we'll get on our social soapbox, and this is going to be a fun episode. So we'll do the social soapbox on another time, because I think that you'd be a perfect person to speak on a lot of these topics. But
I'm so opinionated, sure.
Okay, well, you know, twist your arm, ow. But you are somebody who I've known on Facebook for a hot minute, and I've kind of been stalking you for a little bit, and you and I have become friends over the last few months, and I'm very pleased to have you here on the show, because I've had a chance to meet you a couple of times and hear a little bit about your career and your story and all of that. But for people who have not heard about who Bruce Hart is, and if they see your picture, or I could, you know, sit here and read your IMDb credits, you know, because you've got a ton of things that you've been in since it looks like about 2007 or 8 up until now, and now you're this busy little bee. Tell us who Bruce Hart is, and, you know, just a little bit about your background and where you grew up. I know you grew up in Michigan, but what was life like for you?
Sure. Well, I have a confession to make. I actually have IMDb credits back to the 80s, but through a major stroke of luck, when I dropped in and out of Screen Actors Guild and I rejoined, there was another Bruce Hart, so I had to become Bruce L. Hart. And so that split out. So I was able to basically, you know, in a sense, say I'm younger. Yeah, I even got a note from IMDb saying there's a huge gap between some of your credits in like 1988 and 2007. Are you the same person? And I sat there and I sat there and finally I said, no, I'm not. I moved out in the 80s, believe it or not. It was a much different vibe in California in the 80s. For one thing, the weather was better. Economy was better. You know, Garrett, I didn't want to be an actor or a producer or anything when I moved out here. Did you know that?
No. What were you going to do?
I just came out here to look for a job and to get out of Michigan. And, boy, I'm glad I did that. But, I came out here, and my brother already worked in the film biz as an editor and a director. And I started just kind of doing a little bit of extra work here and there, and then I started picking up, you know, when you're younger, too, it's a little easier. I started picking up some small parts in episodic television, like I was on Just the 10 of Us, one of those three-camera shows in front of an audience. Yeah. And then I got actively involved in 99-seat Waver Theater in its heyday. It's really going away, and it's been going away for quite some time, but the glory days were the 90s. And I wrote, produced, and acted in, like, tons of shows. And we had – and the sad thing about theater is once it's done, it's gone, you know?
Right.
But my producing partner and I had so much success at this. We were – you know, had a reputation for producing hits. We had one show that ran off and on for 3 years. It was just amazing. And I was in it. So that was my weekend job. You know, I had a day job, and I would just drive up to L.A., from where I was living in Long Beach, and do my three performances on the weekend, and it was just an absolute blast, and it's just amazing. So, you know, we did that for quite some time, and it started to trend, you know, like all good things come to an end. Theater started to go the other direction. People stopped wanting to go. I don't know if it was economics or what, but we produced another play called Naked Deception, which is towards the very end of the heyday. And it was a spoof, actually, on bad gay theater. You know the kind of sleazy shows where people just essentially walk out naked. So we built it around. I wanted to do this for a joke. We built it around the barest of bones plot, and we hired an adult entertainment actor, Dylan Box, who was trying to cross over into more mainstream material. He's a really good actor, a very funny comedian. And so when he stepped into the show. The show was a hit. I made so much money off that thing. And it ran 8 months, which for that time period was a pretty good track record. 8 months, yeah. And, Garrett, that's the one that kind of led to getting into producing, because we were approached by some investors about making it into a feature film, you know, and a distributor and all that.
Who's so, you know, like young and cute and impressionable when, you know, you have people, you know, coming to say, hey, we can turn this into a movie. What does that do to you?
Well, let me just tell you, a number of times with shows, we had people come up and say, hey, I'm going to make you into a star. I used to make jokes. I'd say, there's a talent scout in the audience from Metro, and they want to sign you to a starlet contract. like anything in show business, you have to have a good BS meter.
Sure.
So you have to be able to separate out who just wants to hang out with an actor, who wants sex, who doesn't really know what they're doing, who doesn't really have any money. So we had a number of disappointments down the road with other shows where somebody said, hey, we're going to make it into a film. This particular time, you get a little tougher and a little meaner. And I'm kind of like, show me the money. So we got ourselves a lawyer to help us knock out the deal, which is really what you do.
Yeah.
It's easier said than done because you have to ask around. And as soon as anybody hears you might have a film deal, you know, you either get people that are really helpful or, you know, this time of life, or you get the people that aren't really your friends, the frenemies.
Yeah.
Don't want to lead you down the path to destruction and rocks.
Is that silly, though?
What, the competition?
The frenemies. Yeah, because it's like, you know, in my opinion, there's enough for everybody. So I'd rather have everybody be successful because then it's better for everything. You know, it's like you said, you know, you had that golden age of the 99-seat theater, and, you know, for years, and you did really, really well. And then, it, you know, something happened and the whole thing changed. And it's just, it's really sad that you have artists who are doing great work like you were doing. And then that's not, you know, the rug's kind of pulled out from underneath your feet. But, you know,
I read an article, and I'm going to go back to the movie deal in a minute, by Quinn Cummings. She's a child star who actually did very well in another line of work. She developed something, I believe, a baby carrier or something like that. She's very well off, and she writes lots of opinion pieces. But she was saying about how different the entertainment industry is today and how much harder it is even just to make a marginal living. And it's true. So let's go back and I'll talk to you about this film deal and I can kind of explain that a little bit if you want to hear more about it. So we decided we wanted to change the title of the movie to Homewrecker. So that's the big feature film that I produced. And we actually had a distributor come up and offer us a deal. And not one, but two, but three distributors. And this is truly the glory days. This is about 6 years ago. This does not happen anymore. There are there are no old-fashioned distributors. What's nice about a distributor is they do everything for you. In other words, they package it, they put it out on DVD, they get you into all the right film festivals, you get flown everywhere. It really is a little bit of magic, you know. They negotiate broadcast deals for television. The bad part about it is, particularly in a niche market like gay entertainment, the dollars are smaller, and a lot of the distributors, you have to be really careful. I don't want to come out now and say they're crooked, but they're definitely out for themselves. So I think the distributor was a little surprised when I brought a lawyer into the negotiations for that also. But, you know, you just have to do that.
What was their reaction when you brought the lawyer in? Did the people that you meet with, you know, freak out a little bit, or did they expect that? How did that impact what went on that day?
Yeah, they did. And my brother and I were like, oh my God, I hope this doesn't make the deal fall apart. And finally, I'm like, you know what? We've gotten this far. I need to have a lawyer involved. I need to know how long they're going to license the film, what they're going to license it for. And don't forget, video on demand and streaming really hadn't even come into play yet. So our contract was really for DVDs, film festivals, and broadcasts, and we retained the streaming rights and the foreign rights. So, you know, there were endless opportunities after that to make more money in the foreign market, you know, in the streaming market.
And so do you look back and, you know, look at the negotiations that you had at that time, and are you – comfortable with how things played out, or would you have done anything differently knowing what you know now?
No, I'm very comfortable. I think I would have had a meltdown. Producing a movie, you know, this is the first time we'd actually produced a movie. My brother and I produced this together. And I practiced it myself in the hospital. You know?
Oh, my gosh.
Well, because, you know, we didn't have all the appropriate staff that one has because we just didn't know. You know, usually you have a line producer, and I was executive producing and line producing. My brother was directing and editing. We finally had the good sense to bring in an assistant director. We did a lot of things right, and I think I'd like to talk about that, why it was successful, at least in my opinion. We hired a professional cinematographer who came with a crew, and we budgeted all that out. So a lot of these indie movies, and I've been in a lot of them, they don't do that. They either have a camera or a friend has a camera and some lights, you know. And you show up on day one, and there's like two lights and, you know, a camera, and the director's standing behind it. And you're like, what, we're shooting it in your apartment?
Not quite as glamorous as, you know, as you're thinking about. You're right, right.
Heck no. But for Homewrecker, we actually shot it on sound stages. I mean, this is how spoiled we were, so I thought it would always be like that. We shopped around. We found a studio with sets in Van Nuys for most of the quote-unquote locations. And a little-known fact is when you're making movies, there are whole neighborhoods out in the valley that have houses that aren't really houses. They're built in the neighborhood, but they're shells. And
really?
You rent them. Oh, yeah. And they don't want people to know that either. So you rent them and you go in discreetly. And when you go inside, they have, you know, really no ceilings, like the staircase goes nowhere. They're like movie houses. And they usually have some semblance of, like, furniture and things like that. So, yeah, we shot all the living room stuff in one of those movie houses.
I love that. So it's like going to Universal Studios or a movie lot, except you're in the middle of the valley someplace.
Yeah, and you know, all the little naive things, I thought it would always be like that. We had an 8-hour film shoot day every day. And, you know, most movies, they shoot 12, 15 hours. I just started that later, much to my chagrin. People kept saying, oh, this is such a painless shoot. And I'm like, really? Oh, that's great. You know? it was fun. And renting the movie house, we rented it from this lady. I don't want to say who it is, but she was kind of the quintessential, you know, don't mess up my set. So she would always show up to check on things. And we would be like, oh, no, she's coming. Quick, move that stuff out of the way where we said we weren't going to put it and that kind of stuff. And sometimes she'd come in and yell at me, I told you that. I mean, you just have to stand there and take it in front of the whole cast and crew. So, you know, the things we do, the shit we put up with.
So how long did it take to film Homewrecker?
25 days. We shot 20 days. And like many movies, we were unhappy with the ending. So we went back and did pickups and reshot. And I think I can tell this one story. It's interesting. It was the movie is a direct lift from the play, and there's this couple that lives next door that are in kind of this weird open relationship, and they have this kid that lives with them. He's their pool boy. He cleans their pool, and they also, you know, are in a three-way relationship with him. Well, when we cast the movie, not everybody from the stage show made it to the movie for various reasons. The money people wanted certain people. And we were trying to diversify a bit more. So we hired this great actor to play that role of Donovan, Ernest Pierce, and he's African-American. And, you know, he came in, he was really funny, you know, we shot the whole darn thing. We were done. We're putting the whole thing together, and I'm looking at the footage, and I'm like, we're calling him a pool boy, and he's black. You know, I'm like, And so my brother and I sat down, and we said, well, you know, this whole sort of little relationship next door thing with the three of them isn't working anyway. So we cut it. We went in, and we dubbed over. We reshot stuff, and we changed him to be their tenant who was renting the pool house in the back.
Oh,
and,
my gosh.
We did it pretty, yeah, wow. We did it pretty efficiently, too. Yeah.
Just that's kind amazing. Of like a major rewrite.
Kind of, but I'm glad we caught it, and I was glad we had, you know, a lot of ADR to do, dubbing over and all of that. And while we were at it, we, at the time, were referring to the married couple as partners. But the whole thing for, you know, marriage equality was you know, gearing up. So we went in and we dubbed over the word husband over every time we said it.
Wow. So kind of,
and Garrett, if you look really closely.
You're progressive.
So their lips go one way, but husband comes out. It's kind of funny. Oh. I like to look at that stuff and chuckle.
Well, just like a Japanese monster movie.
It's really good dubbing. We used a really good sound house, so it's in Dolby Stereo, so you really can't tell. But I was relieved we caught that before we made an innocent but inadvertent, you know, negative statement in the film. Oh, my gosh, yeah. So that film has done very well. It's finishing out its life, as I like to say, on heavy rotations on demand. You can get it online. I think it's going to go on to Hulu next. So
way to go.
I know. I'll go into Starbucks or something like that, and somebody will say, I saw you on some, like, movie. And I'm like, oh, yeah, it's probably Homewrecker. But sometimes it's not, but it's just funny. Oh.
Well, you have quite a range of capabilities here in the biz, as they say. You know, you've been an actor, a producer, you've even directed, you've been a writer. Where does your creative juice come from?
It comes from the desire to create things, particularly gay-themed projects, where I haven't seen myself in them. For example, Homewrecker is a spoof on a Lifetime movie, except the characters are gay. So basically, we're taking gay characters and we're not having stories about suicide or HIV or AIDS, and those are important topics, but instead of it being gays as victims, it's gays in normal everyday life. So that's really where my passion is. And so every time I write a script or get involved with something, I want it to be like that. Somebody referred to it as heteronormative. I don't know if that's really the correct term, but, you know.
Yeah, I've heard the term, but I like how you describe it better.
It's kind of like when I was watching Brokeback Mountain, and I know a lot of people love this movie, but I actually did not. I was unhappy that a movie was made, and then it was set back in time so they could have another victim story, you know? And you know, just indulge me for a minute. I said, well, I'd rather them make a movie about a gay couple that gets married and moves to Indiana, to the suburbs, and everybody has to deal with it. That would be a much more interesting story to me, you know?
Well, from a current day standpoint, absolutely, you know, and because it's something that I think a lot of communities were finding out, especially with the Supreme Court ruling last week. You know, we're seeing very clearly where there's a lot of communities around the country who are saying, well, you know, this kind of stinks and we're not all for it. You know, so taking that, you know, a gay couple and moving them to somewhere in Indiana, I think would be really hysterical.
Yeah, don't steal my idea.
No. Yeah, no, I'm
going to
do
protest marches.
There you go. I was going to say, I'll come and ask you for a partner movie, Bruce. So, you know, no, I wouldn't steal it at all.
We'd love to have you in our new movie.
Yeah.
I used to do protest marches, though, and one of the things we'd say when we marched down the street in Michigan many years ago was, we are everywhere. And it's true.
Well, yeah, and I think that's one of the nice things about marriage equality, not to get, you know, off on that completely alternate, time-consuming, fantastic subject that we can talk about for weeks. But I think that that's going to be really surprising for a lot of folks that, you know, they have, you know, we see time and again that they were like, you know, we didn't want to say anything and we've stayed in the closet because, you know, we didn't want to, jeopardize or do this. But now that it's legal, you know, we're going to come out and we're going to get married. And I am so happy for all of these people that they can actually go out and do this now.
Me too.
You know? So, you know,
I don't think I personally want to get married, but I've certainly played enough gay married couples in my life.
Well, speaking of that, though, you've actually walked down the aisle in an entertainment project with somebody who's been on the show with me some time back, Mr. Greg Louganis. What was that like? And tell me about the project.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm a regular or a semi-regular on a digital series. Those are, you know, web shows. It's called Old Dogs and New Tricks, and it's produced by Leon Acord, who also stars in it. And he brought me onto the show after it was up and running. They've got a really great cast. It's kind of like a gay male Sex and the City. It's very well written and it's very well shot. I need to say that first and foremost. And they have a lot of main people in it. But he brought me in to play kind of a mean frenemy character to his character. And he liked what I was doing so much, I've just been on it ever since. And there was a two-part episode where the four main characters were invited to a wedding by me, and I'm marrying, like, the man that they all lusted after. And I deliberately invited them to my wedding just to be a bitch, basically. Anyway, and that character is Greg Louganis. And
isn't that spectacular? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I've had contact with him off and on, but oh my Lord, when he showed up on the set, I got to tell you, he looks every bit as good in person.
He's a handsome man.
Oh yeah, I kept feeling like I was standing in like somebody else's close up or something when I was next to him. I'm like, more makeup, more lights.
Now,
he's really nice. He's funny.
I, before I forget, I want to make sure to have you talk about the pictures that surfaced recently when Greg got married and who was not in the picture.
That's actually kind of funny. We got married in white tuxedos, and at the time we were both kind of bitching. We're like, oh, I don't want to wear a white tuxedo, but that's what costumes gave us. So there we were wearing our white tuxedos getting married at that beautiful hall in Sherman Oaks. I can't remember the name of it off the top. Sportsman's Lodge. It's very nice. All decorated up for a wedding. And then, you know, we kissed, and there were all these cameras around, people taking photos and, you know, press and things like that, and people that shouldn't have been on the set. And a short time later, about a month later, Greg was ready to get married to Johnny Chaillot, and he did. And they got married wearing white tuxedos. Can you figure out what's coming next?
Let me see.
You know, I don't really look like Johnny, but we sort of look the same. Well, there were some mistakes with the photo releases, and Wire Services released some photos of Greg and me from the fake wedding as opposed to Johnny and Greg. And I had a relative call me up. They were like, oh, my God, I can't believe you got married to Greg. What do you want for a wedding gift? And, pictures were up on Facebook, and people, all my old friends from college, were saying, congratulations. Wow, I didn't know you were dating Greg.
Is that a riot? I love that.
Yeah, it was slightly embarrassing. I have to tell you that it was really nice working with him, and for a number of reasons. One, he's very funny. So, you know, he kept me entertained on the set. Good kisser, too, by the way. We had many takes of the kiss. But above and beyond that, he's what I call just an old pro, and I don't mean he's old, but it's so nice to work with somebody with the same level of experience, the same age, for things like when they're adjusting lights, you know, they know to stand still. When you're walking forward, you know, there's marks on the floor. You have to hit your marks, but you can't look at them. When you're working with an experienced actor, things just go a lot faster, you know? So you can knock out a lot of light. A lot of lighting sets. Yeah, you know, I'm going to just jump, but it's related. I have worked on some other projects, including some episodic stuff that's not Old Dogs. I'm not going to say exactly what it was, but I worked with younger, less experienced actors, and I don't see, and this may not be true, it could be a sweeping generalization, I don't see the same level of dedication to learning things like matching, like if you're in a long shot where everybody in the room is being shown and you use your right arm, then when they cut into the close-up and you use your left arm, just, you know, common sense stuff like that. And it drove me crazy because I finally at one point stopped when we were shooting this one episode. It's, again, it's not Old Dogs. It's another show I was on. And I said, you're not matching. You know, it's not going to cut together. And I don't know. I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's an experience or just younger people get to town, you know.
Why that's important to you as an actor, because, you know, when you were, you shared that story with me, and I didn't understand it at the beginning, but I understood at the end when you told me what would happen if that actor that you're playing with doesn't match.
It's pure selfishness, really. And without belaboring the point, if I'm doing a scene and they have a big shot of us all together and the actor uses one hand, but then when they cut into a closer two shot, and it's the two of us, but the camera's favoring me. Let's say it's my close-up with just a little bit of him in the shot, and he uses the other hand. They're not going to use my close-up because they can't, because it won't match. It'll look weird. It'll jump. And some actors will do that to mess up your close-up, but I don't think that was the case, and I think this is just inexperience. But stuff like that drives me crazy. The other thing that drives me crazy, Garrett, are people that don't know their lines when they come to the set. You know, I'm like Joan Crawford. I know my lines. I know everybody else's lines. And you really need to be perfect. Union rules dictate you need to be word perfect. So it's a little nit of mine.
Can I ask you about that nit of yours? Because that's one of the things that I find fascinating about actors or just the entire business of of show business, is that people show up and have either incredible monologues or just even, you know, two-word lines memorized. And it's, you know, for people like you, Bruce, who are experts, you're the Joan Crawfords of the current cinema. You know, you come prepared and you know all of this stuff. How did you get good at memorizing lines? Because for me, that, you know, like, I think we've talked about this. You know, I wrote all of the songs to, you know, the my album that's out right now. And as I'm sitting here rehearsing for a showcase, I'll still run across lines for songs that I've written that I still screw up. And I'm like, I wrote this. I should know this. You know, so how is an actor, when you're reading somebody else's work, how do you commit that to memory so you've got this down?
Everybody has their own way of memorizing. For me, I have to hear it, so it requires drilling it. And to be honest, sometimes when I don't have somebody around to help me, I'll email a script like to my brother, and I'll say to him, pick up the script and read the lines and just drill me over the phone. Some people just can look at something on the page and learn it by visually. We all learn differently.
Wow.
I will tell you this, when I was younger, it was easier. The older I get, it's harder. I don't know why it is. I can't keep some of these things in my head. And I'm going to tell you a little secret, too, which I don't do.
I love secrets.
Many, many actors do, especially, well, like Lucille Ball used to do it. They read off of cue cards. They become so good. So good at glancing quickly to the side. So in other words, somebody could be holding their iPad up, and this has happened on sets I've been on, just out of camera range, and the person is like glancing at it and then saying their lines.
So it's kind of like Saturday Night Live a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. When you're working with an actor that's doing that, to me, it's, again, I would really rather they knew their lines, you know, because then you can do so many other things. I did something not too long ago with somebody that didn't know their lines, a movie actually, and they had to be fed their lines. So it was like this. We'd keep the camera running. I'd say my line, and then this actor would sit there. They'd read the line. The actor would say it back to me, and then they would have to take out the person prompting off of the soundtrack. I know. It's a very, very unnerving, all the little stitch witchery that goes into these things.
Well, there are things that, you know, that aren't really talked about. You know, you might hear things every once in a while, but, you know, when you're sitting down to watch Old Dogs and New Tricks or Bro, What Happened or Fork You or any of the other projects that you're in, dating in real life, you know, you're sitting down to watch this experience, you know, that's completed and edited and shiny and pretty and there's a bow on it. It's just fantastic. But little do we know that the anguish that Bruce went through to, you know, get the scene completed, either as a producer or a director or a writer or as an actor, you know, it's a big darn deal. So,
and I'd like to quote my brother on this because he's worked in the business a long time. He said to me, he said, all those big motion pictures you see in the theater, you know, in 3D with great sound and all that. He said, do you think they got perfect sound on the set? No. He said, every single thing they've ever done, and he named a few movies, he said, everybody had to go into the ADR booth, that's the dubbing booth, watch their takes, and re-record the hell out of everything.
Wow.
You know, a lot of times they just get crap on location. Yeah, and it's a drag. For Homewrecker, we did that. I mentioned it. We dubbed over stuff. It's hard. It's like that scene in Singing in the Rain when she's dubbing for Lena Lamont, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you remember that movie, but it's exactly like that. They set your loop up. Go ahead, Bruce. Boop. Then you have to try to match it up. And then afterwards, they monkey around with it. And it can ruin a performance, too, because what you get in the moment on the set versus what you're putting in the sound, you know, the sound booth isn't going to have the same level of emotion.
You're ruining the illusion, Bruce. But I'm glad that you're telling the truths of Hollywood. Okay,
I'll tell you one more thing. Sometimes they'll even get another actor when they can't get the right actor to dub over a line or two. It happens all the time.
No.
They get sound-alikes. Not everybody's available. Like Brad Pitt isn't always available, so they'll go get the Brad Pitt sound-alike, and he'll step into the booth and cover those lines.
Oh my goodness. I love that story. Okay. Well,
just amazing. I'm not saying
now you know.
Brad Pitt does that.
No, we're not saying not allegedly. You know, we're not saying anything.
Allegedly.
Okay. We've got 20 minutes left in the show tonight. So I've got tons I want to talk to you about, but there are things that I want to make sure that we talk about and get covered, mm-hmm. like a new project that you were working on that you are also going to be doing some crowdfunding on. Can you tell us about the project, how that's all going to play out, and what's involved?
Yes. Okay. In short order, the name of the film is Open, and it's a comedy. It's a bedroom comedy, back to my heteronormative story. It's was written by a screenwriter who at this point in time does not want to be named, but this particular person is an award-winning screenwriter and wrote this movie to reunite some of the cast of Homewrecker. So are you with me so far?
Ooh, yes.
So it's going to be me, Peter Shaliga, who played my husband, and we're going to be playing a different couple, but we're playing a couple again. Rebecca Cochen from the Eating Out series is coming.
Nice.
To be part of it. Dante the Comic from Last Comic Standing. He's hilarious.
Oh, wow.
Brian Nolan from The Lair and a bunch of Lifetime movies. And Leon Acord from Old Dogs New Tricks is going to be in it. And he and I play, actually, instead of being enemies, we're friends in this movie. It's the story of a couple, Peter and me, that are celebrating one of our wedding anniversaries. And we're kind of gotten a little bored with, you know, the whole monogamy thing. And we have these friends played by Brian and Leon who are the swingers. You know, they're in an open relationship. And we start getting this sort of antsy feeling of, you know, what would it be like if we played around with having an open relationship? So it's a comedy. We put together a whole bunch of rules and make a rule book. You can't really sleep around. You can only go out on casual dates and, you know, on and on and on. But anyway, as you can guess where the story goes, it just spirals out of control and they practically destroy their relationship in the process. So I think it's probably, and I'm biased, but it's probably one of the best scripts of this type of genre that I've read. And it was written a year ago. We set it aside because I was a little concerned about what was going to happen with the Supreme Court ruling. And I was very worried that if they didn't rule, you know, on the right side of the law, ruled against marriage equality, that people wouldn't take too kindly to a comedy storyline about a married couple that made me wanted to step out. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So I wanted to wait, and I'm so glad I did because we did some improvements on the script and did some rework, and it's a lovely script, and we're going to have a lot of other surprise actors that I can't say who they are yet, but we're in talks with a few other people that I think people are going to be really surprised to hear about. So, yeah, we had our first reading, our first and final reading of the new script last week. It test read really well. So now we are moving ahead with the scary part, the crowdfunding.
Oh!
I know, oh my God. I have to tell you, Garrett, I've never done crowdfunding before. I donate a lot to other people's projects, but Homewrecker, you know, we got lucky. We just got the money.
Right.
So, you know, it's a whole other world we're in now.
So to do something fun for Open, you know, so you have like the right production quality, the right editing, the right sound, the right lighting, all those things that go into making a quality picture. How much money do you hope to raise in your funding project?
I hope to raise $100,000. And don't laugh. Some people will say that's too low. Some people will say that's outrageously high. I happen to know it can be done for $100,000 on a SAG New Media contract because my brother's developed a budget, and he does this sort of thing for a living. So I happen to know for a fact everybody will get paid. It'll be a union production. And we'll be able to have what I consider to be good production values. Again, in Homewrecker, we kind of set the bar pretty high, and I want to do that again. I want to have lighting. It's a long story, but I want to have lighting that matches in the close-ups from the master shots. Mm-hmm. In a real movie, they relight. Every time they move a camera, they relight. And when we're shooting digitally, you need a lot of lights. But in a lot of indie movies, they don't do that, Garrett. They just do say, we'll sort of have some general flat lighting, and then, you know, they'll move the camera around for close-ups, and they'll go back for a long shot. And people look like, you know, Baby Jane Hudson because they're not relighting. The first time I made one of these movies, what they call a micro-budget movie, I show up on the set, I'm all happy and perky, you know, we're shooting this little scene at the door, right? The director goes, can you cheat out a little bit? And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, when you say your lines to him at the door, can you sort of turn towards the camera? I said, well, aren't you going to shoot it one way and then flip the camera around and shoot it the other way? And he said, no.
Oh, my.
And then I look over and there's one light. And I'm like, I'm no ingenue. I'm going to look like hell. Oh, my God. It wasn't quite as bad as I thought it would be, but it's very different, you know. And so we want to shoot it in the grand tradition of good lighting and good production value. So 100K. And we are going to go on to Indiegogo. And the reason why we're using Indiegogo is if you don't make your target, you still get to keep what you've made. You pay a fee to Indiegogo, but if you use some of the other funding, I think one of them is, what is it, Kickstarter?
Right.
If you don't make your goal, you don't get the money. Mwah, mwah.
I really struggle with that. I think that's one of the reasons, and I'm not an expert, but I've done a little reading on like Indiegogo and the others, and I don't understand the concept of saying, okay, let's say we want to raise $100,000, but you know, for fun here, Bruce, because that's what we're doing tonight, just talking about fun. You raise $95,000 and you're $5,000 short, and you've called your grandparents and your brother and your best friend, and they're all tapped out and maxed out, and you can't get that last five. You know, you get absolutely nothing, but at least with Indiegogo, you know, I think you pay a different percentage. If you make your goal, you pay one percentage, and if you don't, you pay a different. But at the, you know, at the end of the day, you're still able to get some money. So if you raise $95,000, you didn't make your 100, you're still going to get a huge chunk of change. And that's basically going to let you complete your project, and at least you can get started and then, you know, make that five up somewhere else. You know,
sure.
So I think that's really smart of you.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah.
I think so too. And I'm really excited about it. We're going to have some really good perks too. I haven't launched the page, but it's in development. So if people are listening and they want to go on to Indiegogo, say in 2 or 3 days, and just put in the word open, because that's the name of the movie, and then maybe put in Bruce Hart, it'll pull the page up. But we're even going to offer some perks because there are so many fun little, like, one-line roles. If people want to make a contribution and maybe be in the party scene and have a line, like, happy anniversary, that kind of thing, you know, it's a good chance to, you know, maybe get your feet wet and experience being in a movie. And I can promise you, if you're on my set, you're going to have fun.
And that's,
it's,
you know,
not
what?
Going to be a...
Okay, this is a perfect segue, Bruce, because you have shared some stories on sets with me that have not exactly been fun, but you've also shared some stories that have really been eye-opening in the best ways possible. Because, you know, I'm one of those people that I've told you, I've been very lucky in any project that I've been involved with. I've just been surrounded by fantastic, ethical, professional, wonderful people who have been just dreams to work with. And I say, you know, I've heard these horror stories, and I'm like, that's just not been my experience. So tell us some of the good and the bad and why people are going to have a great time being an extra on Open.
All right, absolutely. So one of the good stories is I did a pilot this year for MTV. Had to audition for it 6 times because it's a show about kids and I'm playing the gay uncle. Walk through a park. I drive to the set. It's in, what, Granada Hills, somewhere like that. Get out. They have everybody there that should be there. There's 2 makeup people. There's a hair person who, you know, fixes your hair. They have a costumer. They have food. They have, you know, you walk onto the set and it was so well planned out. You know, a dolly is when they put a camera on it so they can do a traveling shot.
Yeah.
I walk onto the kitchen set. They say, you're going to sit here. You're going to do this. You're going to do this. You're going to do this. Let's test it. Bam, bam, bam. 2 hours and I'm out the door. I mean,
wow.
Fabulous, right?
Yeah.
Everybody was super nice. I don't think the pilot got picked up, but that's what movie making should be. You know, it should be like clockwork. A bad experience, God, there's been a number of them. Mostly when I work on, I did a TV movie. No, that was fun. I did a TV movie for the BET channel. That was actually great, too. It was like bam, bam, and out the door. Some of these indie movies, I did a horror movie. I probably shouldn't say the title, but we were shooting it on a beautiful set, too. It was way the hell out in Los Angeles. It was this gorgeous panoramic house. And one of the actors, I hit some something wrong with him. I just don't know what it was, but he had trouble remembering his lines. He had trouble walking. He had trouble getting to the set. And it was just a real drag. And I did this one scene where I walked down a flight of stairs and I had one line at the bottom and he was supposed to say his line to me. Every single time I walked down that flight of stairs and said my line, he didn't remember his line. And I'm like, Tooby, please just like do this. And finally I said to the director, and I try not to direct, you know, when you're an actor,
right.
You really shouldn't. I said, couldn't we just like cut and then cut in close up? He goes, no, I want this shot. So I walked out with the director and I said, you've got to do something about this guy, okay? You have to do something about it. I mean, I don't know if he's tired, if he's sick or, you know, whatever, but we're having problems. That movie never got released.
Wow.
And
you got your
stair
master workout.
Yeah, but this is a little oft-told tale that I'm hearing. You know, we got paid. It's a SAG movie. But,
yeah, yeah.
But there are producers that make movies that shoot movies just for the sake of shooting them, and they never release them. This particular producer has a track record for doing that. I don't know why. Yeah.
That just seems silly.
Well, recently,
does he have, like, a blank checkbook or something?
I think somebody's funding the movies and he's just, you know, paying the rent or something. I don't know.
Wow.
He pulled me aside though recently or emailed me and said, hey, you know, I hear you're upset about the movie not coming out. And I said, it was 3 years ago. I mean, I've moved on. I've done two TV shows, three seasons of Old Dog, the television movie.
Said, your life is clearly not stood still.
Dude, if you ever get around to cutting this thing together and you need people to come back from retakes, we're all going to be in our 60s, you know?
Oh my God.
I had another bad experience. I guessed in on a show. And, again, it's a professional show. It's just you would expect things to be more organized when you're working under union contract. And I guess what I've learned, Garrett, is – even the most professional-looking shows have their problems behind the scenes, you know? There was just a lot of angst on the set. And I think probably one of the worst experiences I ever had was this little bit part I did in the movie. Again, I'm not going to give you the title because it did get released, but I drove out to the valley, you know, to the location where we were shooting it. You know, no more sound stages, you know, no more glamour. I walk into this house where we're filming. It is the dirtiest house I've ever been in my life. It was filthy, and there was a dog running around and rubbing its butt on the carpet.
Nice.
Oh, it was just beyond. I'm standing there, and I'm like, they said, have a seat. I'm like, nope, I will just stand until we're ready. So the lady that was doing my prosthetic makeup, because it's a horror movie, she was petting that dog. And then she comes over to do my makeup, and I said, you have to wash your hands first. She's like, what? I said, you have to wash your hands first. So anyway, it gets worse. We go out to shoot the scene, and we're walking out into the back, and they go, wait, nope, you have to come back in the house. And I'm like, well why? And they said, oh, well, the owners of this also do sex acts in the back shed, and she's entertaining a client right now.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm totally serious. So we had to go back inside. There was the evil monster that was going to kill me and my uniform and my prosthetic makeup. And so we go out to shoot it, and I'm looking around, and I see how dirty everything is outside. And they said, all right, after he stabs you, you fall down on the ground. And I'm thinking,
like, no
you know,
way.
I'm just not going to do this. I said, no. You'll have to figure out another way to stage this. I'm not touching the ground.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, live and learn. But, you know, compare that to Old Dog's New Tricks, which is like a walk through a park. It's a really, really, really professional set. Great lighting, great camera work. There was a scene where I get my head dumped in a toilet.
Okay.
And, I actually said, well, if we really scrub out the toilet, they're like, you absolutely are not doing this. They had a stand-in. He had a duplicate costume, and they didn't really even put his head in. They just faked it. You know, they had two people,
right.
You know, holding him on the side, moving him up and down, and they just put my voice in afterwards. Those people are pros, and the director said, what if they drop you on your head, Bruce? You could wind up paralyzed, you know?
Well, there you go.
I mean, you know,
that consideration is huge.
Somebody who thinks ahead and somebody who does not. So it's just,
well,
I don't know, amazing.
Here's where we're at. We've got like a couple minutes left. I need to make sure everybody knows where to go find Open again, how they should find you on social media if they want to be your BFF like I am, that kind of stuff. And then any last words of wisdom that you want to give any listener that's out there listening who is, you know, sitting back there in Deerfield, Michigan saying, I want to move to Hollywood and be like Bruce.
Well, I think it's probably okay to be in Michigan now. It seems like it's getting better. But I digress. Open is going to be, if you want to get involved with the project, you can go to the Indiegogo page and look for Open. I don't think there's anything else out there with that title. There'll be a Twitter page coming live very soon for the film and a Facebook page. And I always encourage people, I do have a fan page on Facebook, but if you really, really want to connect with me, I still have room for friends, and it's just Bruce Hart, and you can pretty much tell it's me. There's a couple other Bruce Harts. Or you can look me up by my email, and I don't mind giving that out over the air. It's brucehart2002@aol.com, and that will pull up my Facebook page. I do have a little bit of pearls of wisdom, if you don't mind. Do we have a minute?
We have a minute. That's perfect.
Okay. I want to say to anybody that's listening today, if you are thinking you want to make an independent movie or an independent film project, you should really do it. But I think you should start small. Don't say, gee, I have a camera and I have all these friends. Let's go make a movie. It's only going to lead to heartache. The avenues for getting a movie distributed these days are becoming smaller and narrower. It's not getting better. It's getting worse. So what I would advise you to do is do what I did. Call people up that have had successes. And I didn't really talk much about this, but, you know, pick up the phone and call, and you can call me. I called Glenn Gaylord, who produced Eating Out before I produced Homewrecker.
Oh, my gosh.
And
that's
I didn't
awesome.
Even know him. Yeah, and Glenn just was such a nice man, you know. He told me everything. So I would say, you know, do your homework and really make sure that you know what you're doing and start small, because I hate to think about somebody painting themselves into a corner, either financially or involving a lot of other people and then not having success. But it's certainly not wrong to have a dream, because I know I had one, and I have one for Open, and I'm hoping for, you know, every success I can get with it.
There we go. It's been Mr. Bruce Hart, everybody. Make sure to follow him on Facebook. Go support his movie Open, which will be on Indiegogo in a couple of days. And we will see you live tomorrow night with Rebecca Fisk. And Bruce, I'll give you the 411 on how to get in early. We'll let you get your call. And you can even use a pseudonym if you'd like. And, you know, I won't tell anybody. There we go.
This is a pleasure. Thank you.
It's fun. So everybody else, here's my single right now, Gay Wedding. We'll be back live tomorrow night. And don't drive distracted, folks. Thanks for being here on Rated G Radio.
Second to no one. Hey, Mr. Mister, our time has come. Hey, Mr. Mister, marry your true love. Hey, Mr. Mister, hot bun. It's a nice day to start again. It's a nice day for a gay wedding. Hey, sister, sister, now you have the right. Hey, sister, sister, she can be your wife. Hey, sister, sister, true love. Hey, sister, sister, go on, take her hand. Hey, sister, sister, true love. It's a night.
been listening to
Rated G Radio.